Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back here on the show once again, May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects. And occasionally she's here on the program, and that's what we talk about. And when she is here, the thing I always say at the beginning of the program is, save your extermination questions. We got a guy for that. One of these days it's going to be spring and the insects will become more active, and we'll have Phil, our good friend Phil Nixon, in here to help you with those kinds of questions. But when May is on the show, we say, well, rather than that, we see if we can appreciate insects for all of the many different forms they take and the ways that they live their lives, and invite people to call in and say, well, I have seen this insect, and this is what it looks like. This is my best description. Can you tell me what it is? And often May is able to do that. Though this show, at least in part, what we will be talking about is the upcoming Insect Fear Film Festival, scaring the general public with horrific films and horrific filmmaking since 1984. I love that line. I want to use it as much as I possibly can. It's coming up this weekend. It's been going on now for a number of years. And generally about this time of year, we have May come on the show and talk a little bit about this year's festival. So that's this coming weekend on the U of I campus. And this year, the theme, animated films about social insects. So we're talking about bees and ants. Ints. And May will talk a little bit about the festival. And then, of course, if people want to call in and ask the usual kinds of questions they do when May is here, well, that's certainly fine. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, it's good to have you here once again.
Always a pleasure.
It's a sign of spring when you show up, because you and the giant insects, you and bad movies about giant insects. It's that it gives us hope for the future of mankind and for the winter to be over at some point. So this time around, ants and bees. Now, what led you to select this particular theme?
Well, this is our 25th festival. You know, when we first started back in 1984, we called it optimistically the first annual, not knowing if we would actually ever do it again. And not only do we do it again, we did it again and again and again. And it's now our 25th festival. And I thought we should do something special for this festival. And I, you know, the Bee Movie, which was an animated film about bees, came out with much fanfare last November. In fact, I rented out one of the theaters at Savoy 16 and invited everyone in our department to go see. We had a special showing of this movie just for us. And it occurred to me, well, it's, you know, sort of a turnabout is fair play situation. We have insect fear as manifested by the worries of insects about humans. So for 24 years, we've talked about how terrified humans are of insects, which leads to these sort of stereotypical monster-type pictures. Why not feature a film that shows insects' worst fears about humans? And, of course, the basic plot of the Bee Movie is that there's a worker bee who discovers that humans have been taking and selling their honey, exploiting them. And so he takes all of humanity to court. Although my husband, Richard Laskowski, is a film reviewer, and he kind of put it another way, that maybe this really is about human fears about insects. And what could be more frightening than an insect with a lawyer? So I guess you can look at it as a traditional insect fear film. And I just thought, oh, here's a long shot. Let's see if the director will come, because, you know, this really is, who knows? You know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Much to my incredible surprise, he was happy to come. So we've got, moreover, this is not only his first, this is not his only film about social insects, animated film about social insects. He was head of layout on Ants, an earlier DreamWorks movie about animated social insects. So we have a double feature. It's a sort of a Simon Smith film festival, but I'm not sure that would pack them in, because probably not many people know his name. And we're absolutely thrilled that he's coming. He's going to have, we'll have a Q&A session. People can ask a real, genuine Hollywood director what it's like to make a feature-length animated film that basically was a box office smash for, nationally, internationally, I think it's past $200 million now. So this is a movie about bees. It really is an impressive feat, or 6 feet. And he will be Yeah, we'll show introduce the film. We'll show the B movie, and after that, he will be available for audience questions. And I am sure at least someone will ask, "What's Jerry Seinfeld really like?"
This is, and if people recall, yes, that perhaps in part the reason this movie was successful was that Jerry Seinfeld was attached to the project, and he is the voice of the
Barry B. Benson, the worker bee, mm-hmm. who has to figure out what he wants to do for a living. People have picked at we have a long tradition of pointing out the biological inaccuracies in the films we show. But I don't know. I have a tendency to give animation a pass because the success of animation depends on not being realistic. You know, nobody cares, for example, that Homer Simpson's family is yellow and they don't have five fingers and it doesn't on each hand. It doesn't take away from the enjoyment of The Simpsons. And nobody's sitting there going, that's not what people look like. Or, you know, some of the things that happen in cartoons that defy the rules of physics. That's okay. That's funny. And I've actually talked to Simon Smith a couple of times, and I asked him about they did have a consultant. They went to see Tom Seeley, who is a bee biologist at Cornell, and they spent an afternoon with him finding out about bee biology, and much of the real biology was left out of the film. And he explained that decision basically by saying, well, it wasn't funny. And they're making a cartoon, so it's not a documentary, and it's okay to be funny. So there are various postings on websites and the like anal retentive bee biologists who are criticizing the many, many liberties that are taken. But I should point out some of these very same liberties were taken by Shakespeare several hundred years ago. I mean, people have a long tradition of looking at bee society and seeing sort of parallels to human society. This is nothing new, and this is just sort of a humorous take on it. So, you know, for our 20th festival, I thought we could get someone from Hollywood, and we did. We got Burt I. Gordon, who, known as Mr. Big, not only because his initials, B-I-G, you spell it big, but because his career was founded on making movies about oversized creatures, including, in Beginning of the End, giant grasshoppers that attack Chicago, Earth versus the Spider about a giant spider, mm-hmm. Empire of the Ants about giant radioactive waste-induced ants that attack Joan Collins in a wet
and shirt. Can you blame them? Really, can you?
No. That's a wonderfully clever movie in which I don't want to give away, spoiler alert, the giant ants take over a sugar factory in a small town in Florida, and they enslave the local populace by spraying pheromones at them. So that one took plenty of liberties with insect biology. So there's going to be all kinds of activities. There's going to be the usual. We'll have bug scope, where you can take an incredibly up close and personal look at bees by scanning electron microscopy. We will have one of the graduate students will be leading groups in waggle dance. You can learn the basics of the waggle dance, the sophisticated means of communication by which honeybee foragers explain to their nest mates the distance and direction of nectar sources, sort of BGPS or GBS, I guess. Really a remarkable bit of communication, considering that somewhere, and I asked for directions from a local person. I actually once stopped in Rantoul at a gas station and asked the gas station attendant where the Air Force base was in Rantoul, and he couldn't tell me. So bees have us beat on that point. So. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I have to say we've had our share of publicity over the years, including the Jerusalem Post, the Wellington, New Zealand Dominion. We've had International Herald Tribune. We've had L.A. Times, New York Times, all kinds of. Well, this is the first time that our art contest has actually made headlines. The Scientist, which is a weekly publication, it's kind of like People magazine for scientists. They're doing a story on our art contest, and they're actually posting the images of the winning entries on their website. So if you go to The Scientist, I think they'll be up tomorrow. And they have an article about our art contest, which we've run ever since the 10th festival, I think. We ask local schools for students to send in their renderings of insect fear or thematically relevant images. And we had over 250 entries this year. Really an amazing response. And now it's gone national. So so that was an interesting development as well.
I'm glad you mentioned the international connection here for all those people who would say to me, Dave, internationally famous film, Insect Film Festival, really. But it is true.
It is
something that has gained among the things that have gained international recognition for the University of Illinois, I'm sure they point most proudly to the Insect Fear Film Festival going on this weekend on the U of I campus at the Follinger Auditorium. Starts at 6, or the doors open at 6. And you'll have the opportunity to see these two movies and hear from the director.
Straight from Hollywood.
And our guest this morning is Mae Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I and was the organizer, the person without whom we wouldn't have the Insect Fear Film Festival, started back in 1984, and most of the years since, she's been here to talk a little bit about the festival and give a preview to get people jazzed about the idea. So that's coming up this weekend. Is suitable for family viewing.
Well, particularly, I have to point out that Simon Smith is bringing a director's DVD screener, and it's 3 weeks before you can see this on DVD yourself. So we're getting an exclusive sneak peek at the film, because it's not available. It's just not available. You can see it on an airplane, I guess. If you're going east on American Airlines, I think you can, on a transcontinental flight, you can see it there. But otherwise, it's just not available. So Virginia got a 35 millimeter print and showed it last week, but we're showing it for free with a director. And he is also bringing the HBO documentary, The Making of the B-Movie, and a number of trailers. And, the B-Movie really took off. There were, if you went to see it in the theater, there's a little clip that alerts you that the sound will be Dolby.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the clip that preceded the B-Movie indicated that it was Dolby sound, and Barry B. Benson explained that it was going to be Dolby. Yes, great opportunity for working puns into just about anything. In fact, it's one thing I really like about the movie. Barry comes home; he's very proud of his report card, as are his parents. Congratulations, all B's is what B's like to get on their report cards, I guess.
Yeah, I can understand that completely. Mm. Questions are welcome, by the way, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Questions about bees or other insects are certainly welcome. On a serious note, I think the last time that you're here, maybe the last couple times that you've been here, we have talked, or you have talked a little bit about the issue with the bees that's going on now out in nature, the colony collapse disorder, and something that scientists have been very concerned about and has been a mystery, because it's been an open question as to what it was that was causing this very puzzling and very worrisome die-off in honeybees. At this point, is there any better answer to this question, what's causing this?
Well, there are is certainly more information, but I can't say anyone has really nailed the cause. In last fall, there was an article in Science from a group of investigators in the Eastern U.S., Penn State and Columbia University, who identified a new pathogen. This was a virus called Israeli acute paralysis virus that was sort of essentially 96% of the time associated with colony collapse disorder bees. So even those authors, though, claim it wasn't the cause, but rather was associated with it, because, among other things, IAPV was first described in Israel in 2004 and has a completely different symptomatology. The sort of principal symptom of colony collapse disorder is that the workers, the workforce, the foragers just basically disappear, and you end up with a vastly reduced colony with just very young workers in the hive. And what IAPV does, as the name suggests, acute paralysis virus, sort of makes them quiver and then become paralyzed and drop dead in front of the colony, which is not what we're seeing here. So they suggested maybe it's a different strain, or maybe there's a combination with environmental factors that influences the infectivity and the impact of the virus. But within a month, I think, after the that article came out, investigators at the USDA in Beltsville went to their freezers and took out some samples collected in 2000 and 2001 and found that IAPV had actually been here for at least 6 years. So it's unlikely that that's the cause. And we've done some work. Gene Robinson here on campus is the sort of prime mover behind the honeybee genome project. And our biotechnology center has honeybee microarrays. These are little slides that are dotted with all 10,000 plus genes within the honeybee genome. And you can use this technology to basically query the genome, see which genes are being expressed that shouldn't be or which genes are not being expressed that you would expect to be. And some preliminary evidence that we've found is that these bees are certainly infected with all kinds of pathogens, but one of the first lines of defense against disease in bees is a group of proteins called apidacins, and they're antimicrobial peptides. And the sick bees, the colony collapse disorder bees, which are infected with all kinds of things, you'd expect to have very high levels of these proteins, do not. So it appears that there's some sort of compromise of the immune system. But that said, that's not published yet. We're still doing sort of validation studies. And it still doesn't get to the cause. I mean, mm-hmm. What's causing this? If, in fact, it's a suppression of the immune system, what's causing it? Another disturbing development. Back in January, for the first time in the history of both organizations, this is not the disturbing part, the American Beekeeping Federation and the American Honey Producers Association, you wouldn't think of these guys going at each other, you know, but they've been extremely competitive and not particularly collegial. First time in the history of both organizations they met together. They had an annual meeting. Over 1,100 people attended just because of the gravity of the situation. And they met in Sacramento in January. And the reports from that meeting are that, in fact, disappearances are continuing. Whatever this phenomenon is, it has not gone away. In the past, there have been mysterious disappearances, but they tended over the history to be self-limited. 1963 in the southeastern U.S. just for a year or thereabouts. But this one does not seem to be disappearing as have past disappearances, although it's not quite so disturbing because it's not so unexpected. People know how at least now know you do not reuse equipment from colonies that have collapsed, and actions are taken to minimize the impact. And that said, I spent, I think it was Tuesday, about 45 minutes on the phone talking to a reporter from Belgium, and they're having big problems now. So she, since we don't know what causes it, we don't know if these disappearances in Belgium are the same phenomenon or a related phenomenon or an unrelated phenomenon. But they certainly, the symptomatology is eerily similar to what's going on here. Hmm. So I get a lot of questions like, what if, you know, well, first of all, Einstein did not say that if honeybees were to disappear, then in 4 years humans would go extinct. And you think about it, why would anyone ask Einstein what he thinks about honeybees? He was a physicist. And on what occasion would he have been moved to say such a thing? And then who's around to write down the quote? And as it turns out, at least according to Einstein authorities, that quote was manufactured during a honeybee crisis in Europe, where French beekeepers were dismayed at honey dumping practices by the Chinese, who are the world's leading honey producers, sort of undercutting the honeybee apiculture industry in France. That's the first time that quote appeared in print, and it was about 40 years after Einstein died. So unless he said it to a medium at a seance, I don't think he said it. But that said, people do ask, well, are we going to lose all our bees? And again, that depends on what you mean by bee, because there's, Apis mellifera, that's the honeybee, the Western honeybee, not native to North America. They're all imported. And we've only imported just a tiny fraction of the total genetic diversity that is Apis mellifera. There are about 24 races all around the world. people probably know about one race, which was an unfortunate introduction. Apis mellifera scutellata is known as the African killer bee. Was brought over to Brazil in the around 1957 by a bee breeder who wanted to breed a bee that could deal with tropical weather, and he succeeded beyond his wildest expectations. And this bee has been making its way northward ever since. Although our Illinois winters, whatever other, however else they may be annoying, they at least will keep us safe from the killer bees. They don't deal well with very cold weather. There's besides those two dozen races, according to some, there are at least a half a dozen other species in the genus Apis. So we have Apis mellifera, the western honeybee. There's also Apis serrana, the eastern honeybee, which is from Eastern Europe and Asia, and a few others that are scattered around Asia and the Near East, the dwarf bee, Apis florea, and the giant bee, Apis laboriosa. So when you say bee, you can even expand it beyond that because there are other many, many, many other families of bees. And anyway, about 20,000 insects that have earned the name bee.
Well, there, I guess, though, one reason to be concerned is that this particular bee that we're talking about is an important pollinator. So there are a lot of other kinds of bees, and if this European honeybee, if they were completely gone, it's not as if there would be no more bees, but we would not want to lose these guys because of the role that they play in nature as pollinators.
Well, not so much nature as U.S. agriculture.
Agriculture,
They are principally responsible for pollinating about 90 crops in the U.S., most of the fruits and vegetables, in fact, the stuff that makes our meals colorful and healthful. And they're also managed. I mean, they're among the world's only managed insects. We can load them up on trucks and transport them 1,000 miles when almonds need pollinating. And that's, in fact, what happens. Half of all of America's bees end up in this month, February, in California almond groves to pollinate the almonds, which in itself is a $2.5 billion industry. Mm-hmm. So altogether, bees are worth about $14 billion to U.S. agriculture. That we can't really afford to lose.
All right. Well, we have a caller here, and we're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest is May Barenbaum. She is professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who studies insects, and every once in a while is here on the show to talk about insects. And here at this time of year, for some time now, she's been in to give us a preview of the Insect Fear Film Festival, now going on this campus since 1984, 25th year this time around, and it's coming up this weekend. At the Follinger Auditorium, they'll be showing the two animated films we've talked about, The Bee Movie, featuring the voice of Jerry Seinfeld, and Ants. And that was the one with Woody Allen in it? Okay, yeah. So if you're looking for something to do with your family, this would be a nice thing to do.
I suppose we could call it the Jewish New York Stand-Up Comedian Insect Fear Film Festival, too.
It would be a little harder to put that on the T-shirt.
Marquee, yeah.
Exactly. All right, let's talk with someone here in Urbana, line number one.
Hello?
Yes.
Can I tell you a story about a spider?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. Well, last summer, my daughter was here, and she was helping me clean out junk in the garage, and it was late. It was dark outside, and we had lights on, and we came out of the garage, and between the garage and the house, there's a clothesline, and right up next to the garage, between the garage and the clothesline, there was a spider web that a spider was building, creating. And it was just so miraculous to watch this. And he knew exactly what he was doing. And so this went on for a week or more. Every night there was a new spider web. And then in the morning, almost every morning, it would be gone. So I presume that he had captured something, and that's why the spider web was gone. But he never wove this spider web the same way twice. One time he went from left to right, another time he went from right to left, another time there was a longer kind of an oval shape at the bottom rather than a circle, and at that time he went back and forth inside the web, back and forth several times so that so he would get a circle. And I just stood and watched that for the longest time all those nights, And I was just so amazed that this tiny little creature seemed to have so much intelligence. He never did the same thing exactly the same way. I mean, I'm just amazed. Aren't you amazed?
Well, I have to say I am incredibly grateful for your story, because I was sitting here braced for the – my daughter went out and she was bitten, and I got it, and she got an ulcer on her arm. And I was really expecting one of those stories. So thank you so much. It is one of the most remarkable bits of animal architecture, this ability that
this tiny little creature – has so much intelligence.
Well, you know, as much as I love arthropods, I'm not sure it's certainly ability, whether it's intelligence or not. A lot of this is pretty hardwired. Although there may have been subtle differences in web construction, each species pretty much makes the same form of web. You don't see a sheet web spider making an orb. You see an orb weaving spider making a trap door. You know, so they're pretty programmed, but it's still what you'd say intelligence part of it is, if a spider is not getting a high enough hit rate, if it's not getting enough insects to hit its web, it will take down its web and move it to someplace else. And it's like a fisherman who, you know, is having no luck in one corner of a stream will walk to some other place and cast a net. Or Cass is his – I can't do sports analogies. Anyway, and you know what they do too is these spiders tend to eat their webs, because it's an enormous investment in silk, which is
maybe that's where it went.
So a lot of them will put their webs up at night, eat them, and then spin them again in a new place.
Oh, well, that's a good conservation, isn't it?
And then one reason – you say, why not just leave it up? Well, a couple of reasons is if you leave it up, then nobody can see it during the day, yeah. And there are often
– I said that it was never left up. Yeah. It was almost always
right.
Gone.
And spiders will take them down, because otherwise they run the risk of having their webs damaged by large vertebrates blundering through them.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was a very good observation, and it really is a pretty remarkable bit of behavior.
We had a rainstorm, and after the rain, he never came back.
Life of spider is tough.
I'm just so amazed, and I just have to call it intelligence.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it does involve the brain, and we know that because there's a fellow named Peter Witt who, during the 50s and 60s, studied the impact of pharmacologically active substances on spider web construction. So he gave the spiders caffeine and alcohol, and I think there's at least one experiment with LSD, and you know what, those drugs did affect the ability of those poor spiders to weave their webs.
So it diminished their ability to do that.
Yeah, well, certainly it did change the nature of the webs. The over-caffeinated spiders spun way too much silk.
Oh my goodness, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, I've never been able to share this story with anybody.
Well, it's a great story.
I'm just so amazed. I just can't forget it. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Other stories or questions that have to do with insects are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And our guest is May Barenbaum. She's an entomologist. She's a scientist who studies insects, and she's head of the department here at the U of I. And we have been talking a little bit about this weekend's upcoming Insect Fear Film Festival, now going on since 1984. Did you ever think in 1984 that now 25 years later that you would you still be talking about that?
And, you know, people keep asking me, don't you run out of movies? No. Hollywood has very few fresh ideas, and the idea of insects in movies is a pretty venerable one.
And something about something about their nature or the way that they look. I think it time and time again, when particularly in, say, in horror or science fiction, if you're looking for something to base a creature on, and you're looking for a creature that's going to be really scary and very alien, something not humanoid, as far away as you can get from the way that we're designed, insect is always the thing.
And it's the one group that is politically correct to hate. You know, you've got a built-in expectation of the audience. You know, they know who the bad guys are when they walk in.
Right. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Also, Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Hello. I grew up in Urbana, and I had never been familiar with assassin bugs or wheel bugs
mm-hmm.
Until, let's see, about I guess a year and a half ago, a friend brought me an insect that she'd found out at Homer Lake and said, what is this? And so I kind of Googled around until I found it. And then I found another one in my backyard, I guess last summer. But I just wondered how common they are in this area and how many insects they sort of eat and take care of, and since they're predators, or just anything you could tell me about them locally.
Well, assassin bugs are in the family Reguvidae. That's what entomologists call assassin bugs, and they are true bugs, which means they have piercing, sucking mouth parts. Now, true bugs can either use their piercing, sucking mouth parts for plants or for meat, and assassin bugs are, as the name suggests, in the meat group. And again, there are some that feed on other arthropods, but there are some assassin bugs, some reguviids, that are actually parasites, that are bloodsuckers on humans. Now, wheel bugs can inflict a pretty nasty, painful bite. The ones with that little ridged thoracic projection. They're not quite as much of a worry as are a group of assassin bugs in the genus Triatomus. Those are vectors of diseases, including Chagas disease, which is called American trypanosomiasis. They tend to be much more southerly. I have to say that I've been in central Illinois about 27 years now, and the wheel bug was a real rarity here, and it seems to be getting more common, and this might be a change in distribution due to, you know, changing, you know, warming patterns. Because it used to be a real novelty to find them, but they, again, I don't have any census data, but they do seem to be a little more common than they used to be.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let's go on here. We'll talk with somebody on our line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hello.
The question I have, you just started to talk about it, is what you have observed, or what people over the world are observing, how global warming or climate change is affecting all of our bugs. Similar to what we know about amphibians, you know, that they're disappearing, and, of course, the poor polar bear, what's happening to him.
Yeah.
Have you observed any trends, or?
Yeah, well, the ability to estimate the impact of global climate change depends in part on baseline data. And for a long time, we've been quite negligent in counting our insects. But that said, there are some insects that people do pay attention to, namely butterflies. And in fact, there's a 4th of July butterfly count every year that's similar to the Christmas count for birds run by Audubon Society. And, you know, just butterfly enthusiasts who have been recording populations and distributions. And it is clear that distributions are changing and abundances are changing. There have been several papers published in very high-profile journals about British butterflies and, in fact, British bumblebees as well. As the temperatures have increased, distribution patterns are shifting northward. So species that are unable to tolerate the cold have been expanding their ranges, and particularly with bumblebees, some of which depend on cold weather, they've actually been are considered to be at some risk. But there are many species of bumblebees that live in Arctic, in the Arctic, and also at high altitude. And just like the polar bears, as these areas warm, the suitability for bumblebee life declines. So the most compelling evidence for impacts of global warming are changes in butterfly and bumblebee distributions. There is also some evidence from work done right here at the University of Illinois that elevated carbon dioxide can affect plant-insect interactions. So enriching the atmosphere in CO2 does have impacts on plants. It kind of ups their photosynthesis rate, and some people thought maybe elevated CO2 is actually going to increase plant productivity, but that doesn't take into account the fact that plants are food for insects as well. And one recent study that we did here in our soy face facility, which is soybean free air carbon dioxide enriched environment. It's a big field just south of campus that pipes in atmospheric gas at concentrations that are estimated will be reached in 2050. turns out in an elevated CO2 environment, plants are less able to make the chemicals that defend them against insect damage, and they actually experience greater herbivory. So we're in for a number of changes. It's a really good question.
Right. Okay. A second question is about pollinators. Mm-hmm. Since, we're having problems with the honeybee, do we here in the United States not have enough natural, non-imported pollinators that can take the place of or stand in for the honeybee?
Well, that's another good question. One of the real attractions of honeybee pollination is that they have huge colonies, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 yeah. workers, and you can transport them and move them around. So our agricultural practices involve planting huge tracts of one single species. So that's why honeybees are so useful, is that they have very large colonies. In places where honeybees are in short supply, it does appear that wild bees can play a role as long as there is enough habitat to maintain the wild bees. Wild bee contributions to agricultural production in this country are about $3 billion worth, but they're very eclectic. Watermelons in New Jersey, for example. And it's because one impact that development and urbanization have both had on pollinators is to reduce the available habitat for them. So in answer to your question, we don't really have a managed species that we can just sort of pick up and deliver. It's like if suddenly cows disappeared, are we going to drink water buffalo milk? I don't know. So we don't have a managed species, but there are certainly a number of native species that can fill the gap. In fact, do even better than honeybees with some of our native crop plants like cranberries and blueberries. There are some bees that are quite good, native bees that are quite good pollinators of blueberries and cranberries.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we'll go on again to another caller. This is line 3, and the caller's in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We have like a little pest problem with, these little moths, these mealy bugs, and mm-hmm. then also we have problems with roaches. A lot of people have roaches. And we noticed ever since these spiders moved in that the population of these bugs has gone down a lot. And I was just wondering, how effective is it to use spiders? Oh, because we have a little 3-year-old, and she eats stuff off the floor and everything. You know, we tell her not to, when we're not looking. And so we're afraid to use, insecticide. And so I was wondering how good is it to use, spiders as an alternative to insecticide?
Well, spiders can be quite efficient biological control agents. So you have a little ecosystem in your house. And in fact, there have been many efforts to try to develop the use of spiders for pest management practices. And in a way, in a home situation, spiders have a bit of an advantage in that it's a captive market, essentially. And in terms of your child, one advantage of spiders, too, is that unlike crumbs and other stuff on the floor, they can run away if somebody is about to eat them. That said, and spiders are all venom. All species of spiders produce venom. I think I think that's probably a safe statement to make. And not all of them present any risk at all to humans. Most of them don't have fangs that are adequately strong to pierce human skin. There are a couple, though, that are poisonous that can cause major problems, the brown recluse and the black widow. But they are way, way less abundant than people seem to think they are. And if you haven't had a problem yet, it's likely that your spiders are just the typical cobweb spiders, theridias, comb-footed spiders that live in corners and houses and do a pretty good job, like you say, of clearing out the unwanted arthropods. So it's not I don't want to be sued if you're if anybody's bitten by a spider, but I used to drive a roommate crazy. I had a summer sublet with a medieval English graduate student. He studied medieval English, and his appreciation of science about ended around the year 1400. And I drove him nuts because I wouldn't let him knock down the spider webs. I like the spider webs for the very reason that you like them, is that they seem to do a good job controlling the local pest arthropods. But he never really
wouldn't buy that.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just one more question. Is there any chance that they might become a problem themselves, that we might have too many spiders and then we have to get rid of the spiders?
That's the old, this is the cat that ate the rat that ate the corn that lay in the house that Jack built kind of problem. Well, one easy solution, spiders tend to be cannibalistic, so they probably will take care of themselves. I've never heard of, well, people will call up pest control companies because they have too many spiders, but that's probably not a function of spider population as it is human tolerance levels. So I can't imagine that they're pretty food limited. And I don't imagine you will be overrun with spiders. And, you know, just leaving your doors open will be an effective control agent, a control strategy for the spiders. They're not going to be terribly tolerant of our 0-degree weather or anything.
So basically, we leave them alone; they'll leave us alone. And,
well, that's the again. As David says, I'm not a pest management person, but I've lived with spider webs, and I'm here to tell the tale. And as long as it's not one of the really problematical species. And by the way, there is no truth to the persistent notion that humans consume an average of, fill in your number, spiders every year while they sleep. It's one of these internet facts that everybody eats at least 10 spiders in the course of their life, or 100 spiders or whatever. I don't think anybody eats any spiders while they sleep. So rest assured, you know, you can sleep undisturbed, I think.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Now, just it seems to me, though, that while spiders will help you with your flying insects, I'm not sure that if you have a roach problem, you could rely on spiders to take care of that for you. I don't think spiders aren't roaches almost impervious to almost anything.
Well, they just they would have to behave in such a way as to blunder into the web. But when he mentioned, I think he meant mealworms or Indian meal moths.
The kinds that get in your flour and cereal.
Yeah.
And
so Indian
like
meal moths certainly in their adult stage fly around and would be very likely to end up in cobwebs. But roaches, they're pretty resilient.
Pretty tough. Yeah. If you really have that problem, I guess what you have to do is go for some sort of trap,
like a bait station.
Yeah, and just put it somewhere where if you have a child or if you have pets, you want to put it behind the stove or put it under the sink or that place where the pets and the kids aren't going to go. And that's probably the best that you can do.
Yeah. Yeah, again, or call Phil Nixon.
Or call Phil Nixon, yeah. Or call, you can also also call your local extension person and get some advice on that kind of problem there. We have about 5-6 minutes left with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, a scientist who specializes in studying insects. We have one call here we'll get to. And others, if you'd like to try to get in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Urbana is next, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, I have a question. I recently moved in from Texas, and we had fire ants down there, and that's considered to be the national sport of Texas, killing fire ants. But moving up here, I thought I actually saw a colony that had moved in to one of our areas just because of the nature of the little boogers, and it looked like they survived a couple winters. Could you comment on this, please?
Boy, that's a new one on me. I have not heard of fire ants surviving up here. I mean, as far as I know, the furthest north they've gotten that's been documented in the literature is Memphis. They are pretty much, you know, they're from the Amazon region, you know, Paraguay and Brazil, and that's kind of the climate to which they're best adapted. Now, there are native Solanopsis species. The fire ant is Solanopsis invicta, invicta meaning sort of basically invincible, which I think they've earned their name down in Texas. But we do have native Solanopsis species that have similar, I mean, they're not nearly as aggressive, but they're sort of similar in appearance.
Do they have the same kind of bite? Because one of the kids actually
not really,
supposedly stumbled into them.
That would be really worth looking into. I have two colleagues who are ant experts. I have not ever seen a report of fire ants up here. They were bitten by ants and got that characteristic swelling,
yeah.
And wow, that's
And that's why I say, you know, you don't forget that when you experience it, and you know, you always kind of keep an eye out. I actually had seen it in one of the parks here in the area.
Well,
if you could catch one,
yeah, and bring it into the department. Yeah.
I'll let you all go after that.
Because I have not seen any reports of. I mean, they're they do get shipped around, unfortunately, because they, you know, they cling to soil and nursery plants. They can be transported in. I mean, since they get into everything, they can be transported in personal belongings, but. An actual persistent colony, that's news to me. My colleague Andy Suarez, who actually works on Argentine ants, which are also a noxious and invasive species, although not so much because they bite, but just because they have a massive ecological impact on communities. I will convey this to him and see if he is familiar with where exactly are you located?
This was in north of Decatur.
Wow. Yeah, and if you do see them and can stick them in a vial or something, you put them in a Ziploc bag in the freezer, I'm sure there'd be great interest in documenting the if, in fact, they are overwintering here.
One other comment about the fire ants. I heard a while back that even the native species here in the United States has a tendency of interbreeding with these, and some of the genome is being passed along. Like they say that the genome for California is almost all entirely one specific set. They're all one big family out there, so to speak. And I was wondering if maybe they had crossbred or they had bred with the local population. That was kind of my initial thought.
Well, that one massive super colony story belongs to the Argentine ants. They all, in fact, what appears to happen is they're invasive here. They're not native here. And when they were introduced, they basically are so genetically similar to one another that they don't recognize other colonies as alien. So they all sort of merge into one giant super colony, which is quite different from their biology back in Argentina and in South America where they're native. The fire ant concern is we do have these other species in the genus, like Solanopsis gematalis, which is a native North American fire ant, which is much more resistant to cold weather than is Solanopsis invicta. So the nightmare is, in fact, if these hybridize, whether the hybrids will acquire the aggressive side of their fire ant parents and the cold tolerance of their North American parents and then create a monster, basically, a monster worse than the one we have. And again, I don't know that that there are mass numbers of hybrids, but that has been a lingering concern. And I'm sure there will be interest if you can grab some of those. Well, I know that there will be interest in trying to figure out what they are.
All right. Thank you for your comment.
All right, thank you. We'll try and get one more here. And we have a caller on our line. Excuse me, number two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, we have kids and I have a ladybug in a little bug box. So I read about taking care of it. So what I saw is just keep moist paper towel and raisins. Is that a good advice? And how long should I expect to hold on to the ladybug? I guess they hibernate in general.
That's right. This time of year, they don't need much. Ladybugs overwinter as many species of ladybugs overwinter as adults, usually in large aggregations. And these large aggregations actually serve the function of sort of keeping their temperatures more moderated against the cold weather. And this time of year, they don't need much. They're in what's called a state called diapause, not exactly hibernation, sort of the insect equivalent. One of my colleagues calls it diet pause because they don't eat during this period. So then really the raisins presumably would be for some moisture, but they don't eat, they don't have any interest in reproducing, and all this will start up in the spring. So if you can get them through the winter, in the spring you might see some sort of awakened interest in moving about and in feeding. Then you got a problem. Ladybugs actually will eat pollen. but they're particularly fond of slow-moving, soft-bodied insects like aphids. And that's what they really need to eat to in order to reproduce. But to keep them alive, you can even feed them pollen if you'd like. I'm, again, heartened that you actually enjoy the company of ladybugs. Ever since the multicolored Asian lady beetle moved into this part of the country, people have not really tolerated ladybugs in their homes very well. And that's because when this particular species overwinters, as it loves to do inside houses, it smells bad. And if you disturb it, will bite you. So presumably, if you haven't been bitten yet, this is not a multicolored Asian ladybug.
Okay. I haven't been bitten, but is it okay to just keep him in a jar in the light? And he does move about. Should he be resting more? Should I hide him away?
The more natural condition for a ladybug to overwinter would be in a dark place. Basically, we don't really – they're pretty low-maintenance pets, actually.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller, but we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. Just before we go, again, I want to mention that coming up this weekend, it's the Insect Fear Film Festival 25th on the U of I campus. It's taking place in the Follinger Auditorium. The doors open at 6, and it's a fun event. So if you're looking for something to do with the family, you can stop down there. Our guest is May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. You can look for her books at the bookstore or in the library if you're interested in doing a little reading on insects. And I'm sure that maybe later on the spring and the summer, when they become a little bit more active, she'll come back and we'll do this again. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.